the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dirk Steinhoff. David, today I'm excited to hear from Dirk because he actually has real experience with some of the things we've been talking about. You know, David, 2 weeks ago we had John Williams on and he was talking about an event that is coming, that he feels is coming in the next couple of years that could translate to hyperinflation.
Well, and there's two ways to look at inflation. You can look at it just as an economic event. You can also look at it as a social and cultural event. And I think one of the things, knowing Dirk for many years now, is an asset manager originally from Germany, living in Switzerland, working with Frank Seuss and the group at BFI Wealth Management. I've known him well, and some of his personal stories, Kevin, it's interesting because this goes beyond economics. It goes to the existential. It goes to my family experienced this.
It's deep in the fabric of his family.
Well, so that's one perspective that he brings to wealth management. And as we look at the Eurozone, Kevin, stability, instability. Dirk, thank you for joining us. We're looking at a lot of things that are happening in Europe today. Just as we've sought to have perspectives from, say, Felix Zuloff, we would like to have a both German and Swiss perspective on the Eurozone crisis. Dirk, we've known each other for several years, and as an asset manager in Switzerland, having been raised in Germany and now living in Switzerland, but still seeing things from clearly a German perspective, there's so many things happening in the Eurozone. Why don't we start with sort of the big picture, where you might have an interesting insight in terms of Eurozone stability or instability, so from a quote-unquote European perspective or from a decidedly German perspective, maybe it even is influenced by where you live today, but where do you think the Eurozone is a cycle of either regaining stability or moving towards even greater instability?
First, thanks, David, for having me here. Yeah, what's happening now in the Eurozone, the final outcome is still open. I can tell you what direction we will go. What we expect is we will see that the weaker countries will have to leave the Eurozone, so they will quit the Eurozone. The stronger countries won't kick them out because the strongest country in Europe, Germany, couldn't do that for political reasons. So what we see in Europe right now, over the last one, two years, is that they are actually preparing for the incident that some countries will quit. They are shifting the bonds from the countries which will most probably leave the Eurozone. They're shifting those bonds from the banks towards the ECB so that the bailout will be paid by the taxpayers and the consequences won't be borne by the banks. It's still open, but from what we see is that the weaker countries will leave at some point the Eurozone. They have to leave the Eurozone anyway because otherwise their competitiveness is so low that just tightening the belts and restructuring debt won't work for the future.
So one issue that's been implemented or attempted implementation this last year was austerity. To what degree has that been the correct measure, a successful measure, or will that be something that backfires as it goes from political discussion to actual implementation?
I mean, austerity in Europe is mainly proposed by the strong countries, so the middle and northern European countries, whereas the southern European countries and the eastern European countries, but more or less the southern European countries, they prefer going ahead with printing money and going into more debt in order to stimulate the economy. The austerity requirements or the suggestions, they come mainly from Germany, also Austria and Netherlands, some other countries. It's a fight. It is a fight between those countries. The reasons from both sides or the arguments are that we have to pay anyhow. So we have to decide whether we want to take the pain now or later, and because of the history in Europe, countries like Germany, they know that the price will be much higher you have to pay for when you postpone the consequence. So there are some forces in Europe, in Germany, they just to tighten the belt now, to take the pain now. There will be pain, definitely, but less than the postponing it. Of course, countries who having received for many, many years or decades funds from the European Union, so they were takers, for them it's the options much harder, so they of course preferred to not to change the system. So it has to be seen. I mean, there is a lot of pressure to the German stance in this situation. It's not only from the southern European countries, it's also from the United States. They also would like to see that Germany goes away, or Europe goes away, to print money, that the ECB does the same as the Fed, and to a certain extent the ECB does this already, so they have changed course already back from what they used to do, just taking care of currency stability and not taking care of the economy. So this was the original idea when the ECB was designed, that they should act and behave the same way as the German Bundesbank did. They changed this already, so they are buying Italian debt, they are buying Greece debt.
Is it fair to say that that's not unlike the Fed here in the US, where with time there's come new mandates added to the old?
Yeah, I mean, they are doing it, but not to the extent, and it's still not the way that all countries agree on. So it's always a discussion, and there are also more and more people saying we have to stop it because this doesn't solve the problem. We cannot print our way out of this situation.
Bundesbank conservatism is something that everyone assumes who looks at Europe and says, given the history of Europe, given the monetary nightmares more recently in Hungary, but if you go back a century to the teens, you had the German hyperinflation, and that really does inform many of the members there at the Bundesbank. Is it fair to assume that that conservative bias remains, or are we seeing the Bundesbank begin to compromise given the concerns they have about the depths of this crisis?
I think that the conservatism is still there, but I have the feeling that they exchange people within the Bundesbank, within the ECB, European Central Bank, which have a different point on that. So they exchange members which are typically conservative and very concerned with members who have a different view on that, who are much more open for money printing. So it's changing, but it's still by far not the way like the Fed acts changing. So I think there is political pressure, and of course it's not only Germany anymore, or only Germany who had the saying. There are other countries with votes as well, and they try to bring in their views, and so they have to do compromises.
As you know, we have a business in Brussels that deals directly with gold, and the last 3 or 4 months we've seen it almost impossible, really since the summer forward, impossible to find physical product in Europe. And this is filtering in from Germany, Switzerland, France, from all over Europe. And there's virtually nothing available because individuals in Europe have been buying physical metals. Is that a change from, say, 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, where perhaps Europeans were not interested and obviously weren't as concerned given the banking crisis, which they might have viewed as non-existent and now in their face as something they have to deal with?
I wouldn't say that it has changed or people just doing it. It was all over the years, over the last 5 to 10 years, that especially the Germans, the Swiss and the Dutch people were buying gold because of their history. Inflation fear is always with them, is always with us, because we experienced inflation, superinflation, hyperinflation, and although it's almost a century ago, but it's still in their heads. But you're right, it's increasing, so more and more people see some parallels to what happened a century ago, and more buy physical precious metals. But it's really concentrated on some countries in Europe. You can also see countries who didn't suffer from hyperinflation. There's hardly any buying because they don't have the history in protecting against inflation.
Well, back to banks within the Eurozone, specifically in Switzerland, not kind of at the periphery of the Eurozone. Swiss banks have kept official interest rates very low for a long time. That's been attractive for a lot of countries to finance their real estate in Swiss bank terms. What issues would remain with Swiss banks, particularly having gained exposure to, perhaps negative exposure, to the real estate markets in Eastern Europe?
As far as I know, the exposure is not with Swiss banks. I mean, you are right, the mortgages, they were written Swiss francs because interest were pretty low in Eastern Europe, but these were mainly Eastern European banks or particular Austria. Austrian banks were one of the largest mortgage banks in Eastern Europe. So
is that a place that we might focus on concern, Austrian banks, as we see things deteriorate in Eastern Europe?
It could be, yeah. I mean, it has to be watched, but Swiss banks, the numbers I read, they have only little exposure to the real estate market in Eastern Europe. It was mainly mortgages given by Austrian banks, in Austrian banks denominated in Swiss francs.
Okay, so it's a currency issue, not so much a financial institution vulnerability.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Dirk, before you moved to Switzerland and became an asset manager with BFI Wealth Management, your background, you spent your entire life in Germany. I wonder if you could just explore a little bit of your biographical sketch so that our listeners would know, for an asset manager in Switzerland, certainly there's numbers, financial issues, economic issues, which bear on the decisions that you make, but perhaps in the back of your mind, the experiences which also inform a perspective. You know, you and I have talked about Jason Zweig's book, and there are the existential or experiential knowledge that's gained from being in a certain context, and maybe you could explore that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I'm from Germany. I was born in Berlin, and I raised up in West Berlin, so it was in the free part of Berlin. But the family background is that my father's family used to live in East Germany, but they had to flee East Germany before the wall was built. And this influences, of course, also my view on things, because we have family experience in what does it mean, or what it can happen, that you have to go quickly away, you have to flee. What it means to your assets, so that there could be a time when you have to leave and you cannot take your assets with you. And of course, we have in our family the whole German history. So my grandfather, of course, told me that World War I, World War II, all these crises, currency reforms, and wars, that wealth can be destroyed or can be lost quickly. So This is why Germans are, I think, particularly aware of the situation, and they prepare themselves, so they know about the value of, for example, real estate or precious metals.
Now, in the instance of real estate, clearly it's a tangible, but if you owned it in East Germany and had to leave, one of the things that you're walking away from is that particular asset class, am I correct?
Exactly. So this is why real estate, only to a certain extent, really gives you safety and security. Another issue is that the Germans also learned that, especially in bad times and inflationary times, what governments do is that they freeze the rents first. So suddenly you have a real estate where you have to pay the maintenance and insurance and all these expenses in an inflated currency, but your income coming from rents is frozen, so it could put you into the situation that expenses are that high that you cannot support the house anymore.
Certainly the real estate experts in the United States that I talk to always argue that rental real estate is ideal from an inflation standpoint, because to the degree that inflation is increasing, you can increase your rents. What you're suggesting is you're not always in control of that.
Exactly, absolutely. I mean, you can see it also in other countries, that as soon as inflation increases too much, governments will take two steps. First, they will freeze the rents, because it's easy to sell and it's easy to blame the homeowners for. So it's easy to sell, because real estate property in general, is sold by many people, but rental property is held only by a few percentage of the population. So any measurements against the people having rental property, it's easy to sell and easy to explain to the people. Another measurement, what happens, so I was just talking about that they freeze rents, but what also happens, and you can see is in Greece and Italy, is they tax real estate quite high. So property owners, real estate owners are seen generally wealthy, so, and they are easy to tax because they cannot flee, they cannot take their real estate with them, they cannot go away. So yes, I would say in a mild inflationary environment, real estate will protect you. In super and hyperinflation scenario, it depends on first if the real estate is paid off, because if you have to refinance your real estate when in an inflationary time, then of course could also kill you. So, and second, what I said, that rents are usually frozen and taxation on real estate is pretty high. So yeah, this is why Germans also love precious metals, or people having experienced those environment, because precious metals, you can take it away, you can hide it.
So it's portability. I mean, you're talking about really some of the most basic elements of what it constitutes. It is portable. It is small. It's concentrated. There's a two-way market anywhere in the world. I mean, stuff that actually is not that glamorous, but are the elements which make it unique and different than other tangibles, such as real estate. Love real estate, but understand its limitations, particularly if you have to leave it behind. Was there any recourse? Did your family ever have access to that real estate again?
No, what happened to us, so just back to the real estate again, mm-hmm. It's portability and tradability, because mm-hmm. precious metals is always easy to sell. If you have real estate, it can be a situation when you cannot sell the real estate. So it's portability and tradability. Yeah, with the real estate, with my family, what happened is my grandfather, he had to flee East Germany because he couldn't raise his kids in a socialistic and communistic way. And of course, he couldn't take the real estate with him, so it was lost. We tried to get it back after the unification, but there was no way. It was confiscated, and it was quite actually sold to a very low price to high party members, communist party members. So it was lost.
Dirk, you may know Ian McCavity. He writes a great letter. We had a conversation several months ago, and he described the dog bone philosophy. You don't know what backyard you're going to end up in, so you might as well hide a bone in every yard. And, you know, there's a sense in which if you are able to leave with a part of your wealth, then portability is certainly an important component. But even that's not always the case, is it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as I said, my grandfather's family, he had to flee East Germany, and he couldn't take his real estate with him, but also the precious metals. I mean, he was actually well prepared for a crisis, so he learned his lessons from the First and Second World War and from all the inflations before. So he had physical precious metals, he had some nice Mexican gold coins, and what he did is he used the backyard approach. So he put his precious metals into, he digged it in his garden.
His real backyard, his actual backyard.
It's actual backyard.
Yeah,
It's real backyard, so he put the gold coins there. But then the situation was when he had to flee East Germany to West Berlin, he couldn't take anything with him because at this time they arrested people. If they saw that people wanted to flee the country, they arrested them. If you had anything with you, of course, that was dangerous because it would have been clear that those people wanted to flee. So the backyard approach is a good one if you have access to it at a time in a crisis and if you can take it with you. But in this case, he couldn't take the gold coins with him. So it was a backyard approach, and it's still the backyard approach because the metals are still there.
They're still in someone else's backyard.
They're in someone else's backyard, yeah. So this is why the lesson I learned is you have to have some of your precious metals outside of the location or outside of the country where you expect maybe the crisis to be, because it could be that you don't have access to it. So you have been well prepared, but you cannot profit from that.
Well, this is in large part why we cooperated several years ago around the global gold project so that, you know, someone who wanted a different geography for their metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, could in fact hold it in a different jurisdiction. And that jurisdictional diversification for us is important because, as you describe it, there are instances in which even what you have in your backyard is not accessible. You can't get it or you can't take it with you. So even that important component of portability is denied if the interests of the state are against your own interests. And of course, you know, this was a very malignant period in time. We hope that every government, our own included, is more benign and benevolent. But we do know something from history that in periods of financial desperation, sometimes political desperation is a part of that. And, you know, that classic, at least in this last year, classic distinction between the 1% and the 99%, that 1% is the easiest to abuse because you have popular support. You have the 99, quote unquote, percent of the population that would say, well, clearly they're to blame. Clearly it's them that have abused the system to their benefit for so long, and, you know, thus the populist argument and support for it. But as you look at 2012, this is an immediate question, and then maybe you can transition to more of a 2014 to 2016 time frame, a little bit longer out. What do you think the most important considerations are for investors today? European perspective, clearly German, Swiss, and you keep a grasp and appraised of a variety of asset classes. Where are the greatest risks? What do people need to be concerned with this year? And then over the next 2 to 3?
I mean, in the short term, it's very important in order to find the right assets you want to go in, is what are we heading to? And for us, it's very critical to find out and to see, will we see inflation or deflation in the short term? So for us, it's not clear yet. There are signs that it could to a deflation scenario quite. Frankly, we have just seen the numbers, the Swiss CPI numbers, consumer price inflation, and it's -0.7. So in Switzerland, we are already in a deflationary scenario, which, by the way, people like. I mean, it's governments and central banks, especially governments, they always they try to sell their printing of money, that they have to do to fight inflation, or that they have to fight deflation. So deflation is always as a monster. So this is something you really have to fight against.
But for the consumer, declining prices, that when was it ever a bad thing for the price of gasoline to go down or the price of a bowl of vegetables to be, you know, 20%? Letting a 0.7 is not 20% off your bowl of vegetables, but a decline in prices is healthy for a consumer.
It's healthy for consumers, and there's nothing bad about it. I mean, people in Switzerland, they like it, of course, very much because they get more for their money. So there is already some deflation in Switzerland, and it's not seen as a real threat, at least not by the consumers.
Now, so on that point, on deflation, you know, getting more for your money, that's a critical statement, because if you look at the last 10 years, or even a broader swath of time, let's say the last 100 years, there's only a few times in that 100-year stretch where if your assets were denominated in gold, then we've just gone through massive deflation. Housing is cheaper than you've seen it in ages. College education is cheaper than you've seen it in ages. You know, so turning things on their head, looking at gold as what we believe it to be, real money. If it is in fact a currency, then actually we've been through a massive deflationary cycle where everything has just gotten a lot cheaper. So the real problem here is that there's a lot of people that don't have their assets denominated in gold and haven't benefited from that. To what degree would that be unwound in a paper deflation? Because obviously we're talking about a gold deflation where the gold owner is the beneficiary. I'll just illustrate with one thing. I mean, because in the U.S., the average single-family home in the last 5 years has gone in dollar price terms from $219,000 to $164,000. That's in dollar terms, a 20%, 25% decline. In gold ounces, that house used to cost you 460 ounces. Now it costs you 99 ounces. 78% decline in value. Your purchasing power is going up astronomically. Instead of one house 5 years ago, just simply 5 years ago, now 5 years later, with the same assets, you can buy 4.6 houses. We have a deflation. Should we be afraid of it? Are you talking about a monetary, as in dollar or fiat deflation, where there's a deleveraging and a contraction in paper values?
I'm talking about the monetary deflation. So, and measured by the CPI numbers, which comes from the government. So, from the investment standpoint of view, it's really critical to see if we see deflation, monetary deflation, or monetary inflation. This is critical because in each scenario, you have to go for different asset classes to protect yourself or to have a nice performance. For us, it's not clear yet, so we have quite a large cash part in our portfolios because we want to see a clear trend in this so that we can allocate those funds into the right asset classes.
In alignment with a more clear trend.
With a more clear trend. So it's right now it's very hard to find any trends apart from the precious metals. I mean, precious metals, it's a long-term uptrend, and we believe this will stay with us for more time. But regarding equity and bonds, for us, it's more sideways, or they're sideways range, or maybe even it's a downside trend. So, but this could change. I mean, in an inflationary, monetary inflation scenario, for example, equities could be a good investment because real companies producing something is better to have if there is a monetary inflationary scenario and the economy is doing well. Whereas if we see deflation, which could come also from austerity measurements, then of course, I mean, if less money available in an economy and the consumers have to tighten their belts, if governments tighten their belts, then you cannot assume or you cannot expect business is doing well because their turnover is going down.
Well, your mention of equities brings us full circle to what you said earlier relating to real estate. Real estate can benefit from inflation as long as it's a mild inflation. But if it becomes a more aggressive inflation, and what would you suggest is the threshold in terms of aggressive inflation where perhaps real estate and equities lose the ability to reprice rapidly enough? Are we talking about double-digit inflation? What would you consider just a ballpark inflation number where you don't think equities or real estate might be able to keep up?
I think they will be able to keep up as long as people don't fear hyperinflation. So it's really, I think it's not that important what number it is. I think it's really the expectation where it will end. And at the very moment, people expect that inflation will turn into super hyperinflation, then those assets won't help their values.
And that's certainly what we saw in Germany, because equities did hold up in 1919. They did hold up in 1920. They did hold up in 1921. But by the time inflation rates were pressing 200% and above, and that specter of hyperinflation was no longer sort of in the back of someone's mind, but it was something they faced on a daily basis, as in 1922, 1923, all of a sudden equities fell behind. And so it was sort of the latter stage where they fell off. But you're right, first stage, they did just fine.
Yeah, exactly. So you pointed it right. So equities will be a good investment in the first phase in an inflationary scenario. If it goes up too strong, then precious metals will be much better.
Now, realistically, the amount of debt that's in the system, I mean, in the U.S., it's off the charts, and we're not the only ones. In fact, we're not the largest debtor in the world. We've got, at least in terms of the rollover of debt this year, the Japanese actually have more debt to roll over $3.1 trillion, and we're two and change. So we have debt concerns. The Japanese have debt concerns. Many in Europe have debt concerns. You've got European banks, which have to roll over, in the first quarter alone, $650 billion in liabilities. There really is a good reason, isn't there, to think that there could be a deleveraging or a discounting of that kind of paper obligation, the IOU, quote-unquote.
We can also see a situation as we had in 2008, that there will be a huge deleveraging which takes place to a certain degree. I think we see this already. I mean, the bond prices, being in bonds was a good investment over the last year. It's a deleveraging. People go out of risk. They're looking for safety. And yeah, this is a real reason. I mean,
do you think there's some confusion in the investment markets today, that whole categorization of risk on, risk off? It was just last week in the Financial Times where they described gold as front and center in the risk on mode. Mm-hmm. Is gold in that right category as a risk asset, or is that just sort of the popular notion? The City of London and the City of New York looking at gold, still denigrating it and saying, well, it's understandable to see why people would move in, risk on only, pure speculation. Is that a right appraisal? Or might, in a deleveraging scenario, might you see people moving into gold as a reasonable credit?
We are seeing this already. I mean, the perception of risk is still the same with most of investors as it was decades ago. From our perspective, it has changed. So for us, really being in precious metals is more conservative and is less riskier than being in bonds. But the investors in the market, they still tend to agree on the perception decades ago. So for them, bonds is risk-free or almost risk-free. But there's of course a huge risk, because there's so much investments from pension funds, from large investors in those bonds, that if interest rates would change, would go up, price and the values of those bonds will fall. And what most bond investors forget is that these movements can go quick. I mean, it's not that a bond cannot fall. We have seen this at the end 2008. Where bonds can lose within weeks, also 5, 10, 15%. So what is accepted as little risk is wrong. And if interest rates really start to rise stronger, then the losses on the bond side will be substantial. And many people will be hurt, because people tend to go into bonds because they are afraid of the stock market. It's too risky. So they're going to something which they see as safe. But what I see is that they will have to change their expectations, because they will see that those safe investments are also pretty risky and you can lose a lot.
It sounds like that will be a difficult challenge for many in the market, because at least in the U.S., we're trained very early on that equities are risky, bonds are safe, categorically, no explanation, no circumstances driving one market or the other. Just everyone has this conception that bonds are safe, equities are risky, and that may have to do ultimately with bankruptcy proceedings if a company is going under. Obviously, the equity shareholders are wiped out, and the bondholders aren't necessarily wiped out or aren't completely wiped out. They have priority. That being said, it's not to say that an investor can't experience a lot of volatility in bonds. Do you think investors have the ability to adapt and learn on the fly, so to say, learn quickly, when they're seeing losses in what they consider to be a safe portfolio, and they can't really come to grips with what's happening to them versus what they've been told should be the case?
It depends on who the investor is. I think individual investors, small investors, they're pretty flexible to change their strategies, so they will adapt.
Perhaps it's the institutions and pension funds that won't move fast enough.
Exactly, because they have also regulations, so they are not that flexible, so they cannot move out of bonds into something different without changing regulations. So they have certain percentages they have to have in some asset classes. So if interest rates go up and bonds will lose, it will be the institutions, the pension funds, taking the losses, the big losses.
They already have a problem with unfunded liabilities, the ability to take care of their pension obligations. They don't have enough money, in many instances in the U.S., to make payment on their pension obligations. That would be a miscalculation that would put them deeply, deeply, deeply in the red. So, but might you say, going back to that long-term perspective, 3 to 5 years, the insurance companies and pension funds may be an area to watch with quite a bit of concern.
Yeah, I mean, we are just talking about investments in the short and mid and long term. I said in the short term, for us, it's not clear if it will be inflation or deflationary from the monetary perspective. We see in the mid and long term a much higher likelihood that we have inflation. The deflation scenario, governments will try everything to get out of the deflation scenario by printing money, and finally all the money which is printed and already in the system but is somehow held back so far will flood the system, will bring higher interest rates. And this is exactly what you are talking about, that higher interest rates then in the mid and long term will hurt bonds, will bring bond prices down, and this is of course not positive for such bondholders like insurance companies and pension funds.
Well, Dirk, as we wrap up, let's play a little game here. You're familiar with the Rorschach tests, where they show you a picture and you give your first impression. You know, it may look like an ink blot, and you say it looks like a beautiful bird of paradise. Or, you know, when I say the word derivatives, what comes to mind?
A huge bubble, and most of them totally unnecessary, only for speculative reasons.
So we have a couple of issues which still have to be sorted through on the road to recovery. What would you be looking for, and as your final comment, what would you be looking for to sort of verify that we were taking the right steps in the direction of recovery economically?
It's hard to say if there are anywhere the right steps to take or if they are available. I think we have reached, or we are over the point of where we can go back without pain. So there will be pain anyway. It depends on if you want to take the pain now or later. So the right steps from my point of view would be taking the pain now, because it hurts, but it hurts much less than if one postpones it. But I know that with this view, I am not alone, but it's still the minority. So I think most people prefer just going ahead with what we did over the last decade. So just postpone the pain, and we call it a muddle through scenario. So everyone hopes that he won't be out of power, or he won't really experience the final outcome. Question is how long it can be postponed. I mean, it surprises me that they already could postpone it that far. I would have expected much, or the problems we have right now actually to have taken place earlier. So governments and central banks are able to postpone, and so maybe they are also able to postpone the consequences for much more years than we would expect right now.
Well, some of your sentiments reflect and echo another Swiss manager, money manager, who's been on the program before, Felix Zulauf, in Zug, not far from where y'all are at.
We just met him 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. The inflationary depression being something that, you know, as you muddle along, central banks do the best that they can with the tools that they have to jumpstart the system, and that having ultimately an inflationary effect, but with very little impact to the real economy as we unwind several decades of excess credit and overconsumption. Dirk, great to see you here in the Bahamas, and look forward to seeing you again in Switzerland for any one of the excursions that we've had before and adventures, and hopefully the markets smile on us this year.
Yeah, let's hope for that, and thanks for the invitation, David.
So, David, what it sounds like is the European Central Bank is starting to take on some of these time bombs. Or maybe they're not time bombs. Maybe the fuse is lit and they're fuse bombs. But one way or another, they're trying to save the individual banks and shift it onto the taxpayer.
Well, exactly. And thank you, Dirk, for sharing that with us. It's the issue of maintaining bank stability, maintaining stability within the financial system, and beginning to shift those potential nightmares onto the ECB balance sheet so that the collective taxpayer across Europe can be paying the bill. Now, on the one hand, that makes good sense because you won't have the financial institutions impaired. If that were the case, you would see a major hit to the European economy. The complexity of the European economy would fold in on itself if you didn't have a free flow of funds via the bank system. But frankly, as a taxpayer, I find that very abhorrent, and someplace where actually there's not a logical consequence for bad choices made. Again, that kind of grates against me a bit. But interesting perspective, Dirk. Thank you for that. And just to see in high relief what the ECB is doing And you know, again, I guess their long-term goal is, of course, to bring about stability in the Eurozone.
Well, not only stability, Dave, but it just seems like there's a common theme. One of the common themes is inflation. The other common theme is just socializing risk. Every time they get the chance, they socialize risk.
And privatizing reward. Ultimately, I think the politics, whether it is in Europe or in the United States, will not allow for that.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dirk Steinhoff. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.